Hej och välkomna till avsnitt 1194 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser med mig Ronny Berggren och till del 137 i Miserium USA-valet 2020. Igår den 29 september så hölls den första presidentvalsdebatten mellan Donald Trump och demokraternas utmanare Joe Biden. Här följer en debattanalys med min kollega John Gustafsson och Justin White, republikansk politisk expert med stor erfarenhet från USAs yttersta toppolitik och en regelbunden gäst här på amerikanska nyhetsanalyser. Varmt välkomna.
So with me now is Justin White. He is a former Republican operative. He's a previous guest on this podcast. I think you appeared the first time it was over 4 years ago, actually, ahead of the 2016 elections. So you've been with us on and off for some time. But for those of you who don't know him, he is he's worked on Republican campaigns for the past 20 years. He worked on the Trump campaign in 2016 in South Carolina during the primaries. But he's not supporting Trump in this election, as I understand it. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it's with a bit of a heavy heart that I feel that way, to be honest. I don't want to come across as gleeful or as some folks who, you know, they may be Republicans, but in my opinion, they're not conservatives. And so it's easy for them to bandwagon against anybody who's not really a Rockefeller Republican, which is a group that I have contended with for all of my life. And I find that most Never Trumpers are in that vein, though certainly not all. And you know, my background, having worked, you know, for Governor Mike Huckabee in his run for president of the United States in 08, and many, many true conservatives over many decades, including Vice President Mike Pence, who I assisted in getting elected to Congress. I'm very frustrated with this administration. So it's true to state that I'm not supporting him, but I want to be clear that that's out of character, out of line, and I haven't abandoned conservatism, just frustrated with this ticket.
So basically, you're not supporting Trump, you're also not supporting Biden, and you also do not identify with most Never Trumpers, basically. You're pretty lonely, one could say.
It is. I am feeling a bit like Napoleon on Elba, I'm afraid, these days. Although, mercifully, I'm not alone, but I'm outnumbered, but then they say, you know, beware of the power of people in small groups. It's the only thing that's ever changed anything anyhow, so all is not lost.
Well, that's an optimistic attitude. So let's talk about tonight's debate. So 90 minutes, we just saw that it finished less than an hour ago as of the time of this call. First of all, who do you think was the winner of the debate overall?
I would say whichever channels were broadcasting something watchable. To say the least, this was the most uncharacteristic presidential debate that I've ever personally witnessed in more than 25 years of watching these things. Actually more than 30 years of watching these things. And so you've got a lot of room for a lot of variance there, including the, you know, sometimes quirky folks like Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich, you know, in their runs for president. Interesting things could happen on those stages, you know, with some of the ancillary candidates and the 15, 20 person fields in the primary. But this was just disappointing is the word I'm going to, you know, kind of hang the hat on. As far as I'm concerned, nobody won. I think Trump lost, but I don't feel like Biden capitalized very effectively, to be honest. I think he was really, as much as he no doubt, as your listeners may be aware, or may not be, there's a great deal usually of preparation that goes into the debate. There's literally a debate prep team. There are people who play the other candidates, often whom are professional actors who are quite good at their job, sometimes including very famous actors who've won Oscars, etc. So this is not a joke thing for campaigns. It's very important. They often get candidates who are from their own party, who are very skilled politicians, extremely skilled politicians, known for being prepared to do these roles. So there's a lot that goes into it. I think Joe Biden was not prepared for the level of unprofessionalism that he experienced. And in so doing, you could argue that Trump had him off his game, which is probably true. But I don't think that it deferred to Trump's benefit. Because, of course, he himself came across as brash, as rude, as insensitive, and as disrespectful repeatedly, which is not to say that's all he did. We're going to talk more about that, I'm sure. But in general, I would say it's a bad look for Trump and a mediocre look for Biden, which I guess is a win by default, but not a particularly grand one.
So, I've actually heard similar takes from other sources as well, that essentially Biden didn't win, but it was Trump who needed a win, seeing as how Trump is the one who is down in the polls. And basically, as long as Biden can keep running out the clock without losing, then he is winning by default. Seems to be a very common position. There's been a lot of the spontaneous reaction from the internet seems to be a lot of people are panning Chris Wallace, the moderator of the debate, saying he couldn't keep things civil, he couldn't keep Trump under control. There were a lot of interruptions, most of them from Trump, but also from Biden from time to time. What do you think of Wallace? Is he to blame for this dumpster fire?
Well, I think two things are, to blame more. I think the format of the debate itself is a little bit unusual. Chris Wallace made mention very early on in the debate that there was going to be like a discussion clock or an ability to just kind of freewheel a little bit. And it was hinted at quite heavily. And that was obviously part of the debate rules in this case, which are, again, untraditional. And no doubt argued for by the Trump campaign, because, of course, the president is not known for being structured either in his speeches or in his debate performances. And so I think format was the enemy, number one. And then because the format, and frankly, because he's the president of the United States of America, which is no small thing, it's very difficult to rein in a president who doesn't show respect without coming across as someone who doesn't respect the presidents of the United States. It's really an unenviable position, frankly. And I think Chris Wallace, took a bullet for everyone by doing it.
So he was a bit of a sacrificial lamb, you could say.
Absolutely. And I think that people will take away what they want to. The president made clear to jab at Chris Wallace repeatedly for being part of the mainstream media, et cetera, which, of course, is fair in the sense that Chris is actually a member of the mainstream media. He is not a chucklehead, unlike some of his Fox News colleagues. And, he is a great journalist and a good man of the media. And so he deserves to be called mainstream media in a qualitative and positive way. But, of course, that will not be how it's spun. The Fox News trumpeters, as I call them, will no doubt attack Chris Wallace for being mean and disrespectful to the president, which no one outside of their own bubble will agree with. And the far left will say that Wallace completely failed his job, and that's just like Fox News, not good at anything, blah, blah, blah. And the truth is somewhere in the middle, that he did as good a job as the participants would allow him to do. And it does go to show you the importance of decorum. I know that in an age of Instagram and 15-second sound bites, we have devalued a lot of the political norms of the last 100 to 200 years. But part of a functioning working democracy is people who believe in playing the game by a basic set of rules. It's like trying to play a game with a child who won't sit still or play the game and, you know, constantly scatters the pieces on the board and wants the pieces to do whatever they
want. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And, you know, we all love kids, but we also don't want them running our country. And I think
I
don't mean
to
be
abusive.
Right. Exactly. You know, 30 years from now, he'll probably be a member of parliament somewhere and smarter than you or I. But in the meantime, you know, he's a child and it'd be nice if he was a little cleaner at dinner.
Yes. Yes, that would be very nice. So I would say, by and large, I agree with your assessment. I think, as I told you on Facebook, the best sum up of Chris Wallace and his moderating was that next debate they should have it on Zoom, and that way he can mute whichever candidate is speaking out of line. And other people went further and say that Chris Wallace needs to put a shock collars on the candidates to stop them from interrupting one another. It seems to me that, Joe Biden definitely wanted to come off as one, presidential, and two, not far left, and three, as someone who doesn't have dementia. I think it was overall successful with that. There were moments when I thought he dropped the ball. We're going to talk about that. But overall, I think he managed to do that. But I think that with Donald Trump, Donald Trump basically wanted to derail the debate. Was my impression. It wasn't so much that he wanted to have something said, as that he wanted to make sure Joe Biden couldn't say anything, that people would basically turn off the TV because they get exhausted. That was my impression, anyway.
Well, and I think there's a lot to all that, but we'll push the conversation forward and get into some of the nitty gritty.
Yeah. So one of the early moments of this debate was when Biden stated in no uncertain terms, "I am the Democratic Party." And I thought that was really, first of all, it gave me Star Wars vibes, you know, the whole "I am the Senate." But I thought that was very interesting, because one of the talking points, obviously, of the GOP and of Donald Trump has been that Joe Biden may not be a far leftist, but he is controlled by the far left. And here, this seemed to me to be Biden's way of pushing back and saying, well, I am the Democratic Party. They chose me. What I say goes. So I'm in charge here. Do you think overall that he managed to balance, to push back against the idea that the far left is in control? Or because there were many other such moments when they were talking about defunding the police and similar. How do you think Biden did at basically calming those who were fearing that he would be controlled by radical elements of his party?
Well, again, I think President Trump sometimes falls into his own echo chamber. And if he were running against any number of candidates, including Kamala Harris, frankly, I think some of those attacks would ring quite true, because they're either of the left or so beholden to the left as a younger, and when I say younger, of course, I mean almost anybody under the age of 60, part and parcel of that movement. The truth is that Joe Biden has been, as the president pointed out repeatedly, in elected office for 47 years. For those of you doing math at home, that means the Nixon administration. So the idea
1973,
that Ocasio-Cortez...
Just to do the math for everyone,
yeah, exactly.
1973.
And so the notion that he is either a product of the far left, which basically didn't exist in any meaningful way politically when he came to fruition in politics, or even throughout the early 20 years of his career, Again, apart from certain districts and states, none of which he was in. It's irrational to think that Joe Biden is the left, and by that I mean the far left, or that he is beholden to them in any meaningful way, because, of course, they've never helped him. In many cases, they've been against him, and so they don't have a lot of leverage over him. And furthermore to the point, we know that, you know, anybody blue is kind of a mantra right now because of, frankly, President Trump and the way that he chooses to practice a bit of scorched earth politics, as others have in the past. But just to be clear, he practices that. And so, you know, the far left, while I don't think they love Joe Biden, in fact, I think many of them don't even like Joe Biden, the truth is that they loathe President Bush, President Trump. They also loathe President Bush, for the record. And, you know, and so there's a bit of that. Trump is not wrong when he says that there are people out there that hate him unfairly. That's true. It doesn't mean that everybody who hates him unfairly. And that's where the nuance is required. But, you know, to that end, you know, Vice President Biden is Vice President Biden. He was Vice President Biden for 8 years. He was Senate, you know, chairman for many years before that, and a mainstream senator for multiple terms. So it becomes a situation where defining Joe Biden as though he were an unknown or not poorly defined, you know, candidate is a act of political malfeasance, actually. It's just not logical. And because of that, you know, I think that, you know, Vice President Biden, you know, is going to weather those attacks very easily. I think that they didn't work. I do think that Joe Biden, to Joe Biden's credit, is the Democratic Party. Now, he is losing that hold, as his politics are losing that hold, as we saw in the primary. The notion that Barack Obama's vice president would struggle, as he did in the beginning, to even win a primary and have to have a elder statesman like the congressman from South Carolina, Jim Clyburn, head of the Congressional Black Caucus, essentially save his campaign, goes to show you how Joe Biden's politics, which used to be 90% of the party, literally as recently as 25 years ago, have really, really waned dramatically over the last 2.5 decades. But this is an assertion that he was able to win both through political strategy and through his mainstreamness, and the fact that independents came into the primary, as they're allowed to do in many states, and voted for him as someone they wanted to be their president and not just a Democratic nominee. And I think that Joe Biden is right when he says he is the Democratic Party, in a way that Donald Trump isn't when he says, if he says, he's the Republican Party. Because, of course, Donald Trump had never run for political office until 2016, and indeed has been a registered Democrat as recently as 15 years ago. So it's, you know, it really is apples to oranges in that regard. I think that Joe Biden can legitimately claim to be the Democratic Party as a whole, although obviously everybody knows that at least 35% of his party is significantly to his left, if not closer to half.
I think that's a good point. And one impression that I have had, and we'll probably never know for certain, but something that has crossed my mind, because as you say, the idea of accusing Biden of being controlled by the far left or being far left himself, that's pretty much ridiculous. People know it's not true. They've known Joe Biden for decades. They know that he's not some pot-smoking socialist hippie. The thing that I suspect is that the Trump campaign thought that they would be running against either Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. They weren't actually prepared for Biden to pull this off, maybe because they believed their own propaganda about him being him be having dementia, or they believe that he will be taken down by the Tara Reid sexual assault accusations, or essentially they were preparing a re-election campaign where they would be running against a far left candidate, and they would be able to ask the voters, do you want Trump or do you want socialism? And now that didn't pan out, but they haven't changed their messaging essentially. Or what do you think accounts for this lack of preparedness? Because it seems like they're struggling with their messaging against Biden. They're using messaging that would have worked against a Bernie Sanders candidacy or an Elizabeth Warren candidacy, but not so much a Joe Biden. What do you think accounts for that?
Well, you know, as someone who had a hand in winning over 250 political races over more than a decade in multiple states and indeed multiple countries, you know, I somewhat famously said in 2008, but also in 2012, it was repeated. And then this case in reference to then Governor Romney's campaign for president, sometimes the problem is the candidate. And, you know, the blunt reality is you can't cast a narrative or run a campaign in direct opposition to fundamental realities. Right. One of the problems the Romney campaign had was that no one thought Mitt Romney loved people, just rank and file folks, you know, and it showed in glaring contrast to George W. Bush and Barack Obama, who both seemed to, regardless of their politics or policies, like human beings to a level that is above and beyond. And now maybe some people are cynical and say that's just an act, but so be it. If it is an act, it's one they pulled off well. And in the same token, Mitt Romney came across very stilted, very unapproachable, and like he didn't like people. Whether that's true or not, that was the zeitgeist. And by the same token, Donald Trump's campaign may or may not work against a socialist, but it works a lot better, especially against someone who is one. And it starts to work pretty well, not because people love Trump, as he very famously said from the stage, if you love me, that's great, but if you don't, you have to vote for me because the Democrats are crazy. And when you looked at some of the candidates on the primary ballot, like Julian Castro, for instance, who wanted, you know, taxpayer-funded sex changes, then, you know, that's a pretty compelling argument. Hmm. Don't vote for them. They're crazy. But the Democrats, with the help of a lot of moderates and independents moving into the primary, chose someone who that attack line just simply doesn't work on. And in so doing, the Trump campaign's central, easiest, and most likely path to victory just absolutely vanished. And so the fallback, of course, was always going to be the economy, except that goes away with the mismanagement of the coronavirus. And so it really becomes a situation where Joe Biden is the perfect anti-Trump candidate among the field. I think there could have been some others who would be even stronger had the field allowed them to exist. But he's personally a Trump killer, if you will, as a candidate. And then through Trump's own mismanagement of coronavirus, which has really hampered the U.S. economy very significantly, he really doesn't have a fallback position to say, Biden or not, I've given you a great economy, which would have been the plan B for the campaign. And now that's gone away as well. So, you know, you have candidate staff and campaign, you know, personnel who are running around trying to pick up a plan D or plan E for the campaign, and it just doesn't work. You can't run the age issue. You can't run the losing a step issue. You can't run the far left issue. You can't run on the economy. You can't run on executive management capability. But you're starting to run out of ways to run the campaign. And while some of them are external, the Democrats choosing Joe Biden as opposed to Elizabeth Warren, many of them are internal. You know, Trump created at least half of his own problems, and he's now going to pay the consequences for that, I suspect.
I actually, obviously, you couldn't listen to this because you don't speak Swedish, but I did have a pre-debate segment with Ronny Berggren, and so my take was that what Trump needed to do was basically not be himself for 90 minutes. If he could, and I took as an example his first State of the Union address back in 2017, which was excellent and which raised his poll numbers significantly for a time because he was actually presidential. You know, it may just have been for an hour, but he was presidential. And a lot of people would agree with Trump on a lot of issues, but simply dislike him too much, dislike his character too much, dislike his divisiveness too much to support him. And so my point that I made was that if Trump managed to not be Trump, to pretend that he's actually a presidential character for 90 minutes, then Biden's in trouble. But I don't really feel like he did that. One thing though that I want to get because I want to get into some because obviously we're both heaping a lot on Trump right now, but I want to go into some of the weaker points that I thought Biden had. So the first one was he refused to answer the question about whether he would pack the court or eliminate the filibuster. Do you think that's a su sustainable position, or is he eventually going to have to make a call on what he's going to do there?
I suspect his pressure, both internally within the Democratic caucus and his position of leadership, temporary as it is at the moment, as a Democratic nominee, potentially significant if he's elected, is going to require him to weigh in pretty significantly on that issue. He may avoid coming down hard on it just because, who's going to attack him for real? On his way to hopefully the White House for his party's sake. And with that in mind, it makes sense for him to avoid it as much as possible because if he runs the risk of two things, if he elicits a path that he then tries and fails at, it's his first major defeat. And in the process, it's a situation that can turn off voters to him and potentially turn voters on to Trump as well, though less likely in the latter, but definitely turn voters off of him if he says the wrong thing, whatever that might be in their minds, as there are some people who are on the left and who believe stacking the court is wrong because it sets up a precedent that we'll eventually have a 17-member Supreme Court. And we're essentially just creating another U.S. Senate. And we've seen that happen in nations that have fallen down before, right? That was a famous move by Chavez, for instance, in Venezuela. When he didn't like the court ruling, he just added four more Supreme Court justices and took, I think, what was a 5-2 decision, to a 6-5 decision when he
That's one way to do
appealed.
it. I honestly think that the first segment was Biden's weakest, partially because, as you say, he can't really say one way or the other on the court packing and the filibuster. But the other thing is that he never actually explained the Merrick Garland story because he said this is an abuse of power, and Trump said, "Well, I was elected for 4 years, not 3 years." And if you are among the low information voters who do not remember 2016 that well, or don't remember what was going down with Merrick Garland, with Antonin Scalia passing away in February of 2016, and the Republicans refusing to hold hearings on a replacement, if you don't remember that, then what Biden says makes absolute perfect sense. I mean, he was elected for 4 years, and the Senate, a Republican Senate majority was elected in 2018. So I think Biden assumed that voters would remember what happened in 2016, and I think the voters that he needs to reach, I'm not sure if they do.
Well, I'll go one step further and state that in one of the perhaps rare instances these days, I actually think the president is right. I think that the voters had a chance to throw the Republican Senate out in 2018, and they didn't, even though they threw them out of the House. And they had a chance to vote for someone other than Donald Trump in 2016, and they didn't. I think that there's a strong argument to be made that the American voters as a whole want Donald Trump to pick the justices. And by that, I mean Mike Pence. And in the process, in the infamous words of Obama's former chief of staff and the former mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, you know, elections have consequences. And if you don't like what the consequences are, that's a damn shame. You should have changed the outcome of the election beforehand. But in the same way that you don't get to lose at a game of Texas Hold'em poker and then have an extra special secret hand added at the end that matters more than all the other hands, you know, there's something to be said for the rules. I think Donald Trump won the election in 2016. I think Mitch McConnell won the election for the Senate in the 2018. And as long as they put someone on the bench who is not a criminal or thoroughly legally unqualified to hold the office of the U.S. Supreme Court, they have a right to get their justice. And I know that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is probably spinning in her grave over it, but that's too damn bad. You know, there is nowhere is it written that you're allowed to have equal amounts of justices for different ideologies or that those seats belong to an ideology. That's simply not how it works. And if Obama had had control of the U.S. Senate in 2014, like he wished and failed to accomplish, then he would have gotten Merrick Garland and there wouldn't have been anything anybody could have done to stop it. But he did it. He failed in 2014. The consequence was that they didn't get Merrick Garland. And I'm sorry, on this particular issue, I think the president is totally and completely correct.
Well, I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on this. But I would like to point out, however, that it wasn't just that the Republicans didn't vote for Merrick Garland, but they didn't hold a hearing. And that is what really made it unique. Merrick Garland never had a chance to go before the Senate and make the case why he should be confirmed. They simply said, no, we're going to wait until the election. And now when a justice, just to explain to listeners where the Democratic argument comes from, is that in 2016, Barack Obama was president and didn't get his Supreme Court justice that he nominated because Republicans said you have to wait until the election. Now, Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away 6 weeks or just over 6 weeks before the election, and Republicans said, oh, well, let's go. No need to wait for the people. And that's
no, basically I agree. Mitch McConnell. Sorry, I don't mean to speak over you. I agree that Mitch McConnell's logic at the time for not giving Merrick Garland a hearing was rank and political, and I disagreed with his way of communicating it. I think he should have had the guts to just be honest, as is often the case in failed politics. The irony is you get more with the truth than you do with a lie. And if he'd have said, look, we won the Senate, we're not giving it to him, we don't care why, and you can nominate any one of 150 people, we're not going to give it to him. And if he'd have said that, there would be no constitutional way to make him do otherwise. He has that right as the Senate Majority Leader, even if the president doesn't like that he has that right. And his option was to use it to take the U.S. Senate away from Mitch McConnell in 2016. And the voters looked at it and went, no, we want Mitch McConnell of the two options. So it's one of those situations where, yes, do I agree that Senator McConnell was disingenuous and even possibly duplicitous in the way that he withheld hearings from Merrick Garland? Absolutely. I think he should have just been honest and said, there's no way I'm letting the Scalia seat go. I'm the head of the U.S. Senate. The people voted me head of the U.S. Senate and my party, and we're not going to allow this to happen. And if you have a problem with it, try and get me. Now, very similarly, the Democrats did something more objectively politically gross when they stopped Judge Robert Bork, who was an incredible jurist, from being appointed to a seat that was held by a Democratic, well, more liberal-leaning judge previously. and thus the term getting borked came about, because the U.S. Senate gave him a fair hearing with a predetermined outcome, in the words of Judge Roy Bean from the Oklahoma Territories in American history: I'm going to give you a fair trial and then I'm going to hang you. And that's what the Democrats did to Judge Bork. And it was carried out on live television, and Joe Biden was actually a part of it. And it's interesting, you know, but the truth is that a guy who helped lead the attack on Judge Bork to become Justice Bork in then Senator Joe Biden has no room to debate whether Judge Coney Barrett has a right to that seat, because she is a jurist of excellent caliber, and there is an open seat, and the president wants her to take it, which is his right, and the U.S. Senate as a body is willing to appoint her, and that is the tale of the tape. There's nothing unconstitutional about it, and I am ashamed of Mitch McConnell for inviting non-constitutional issues into the methodology of the debate around Supreme Court justices. But the fact that he was wrong last time doesn't mean the Democrats get to be equally wrong this time.
So just to go on to another part of the the debate. So there was, of course, a lot of talk about the pandemic. And one thing I found, because we were talking about things that Biden had some weaker points, I think the corona pandemic is one of his stronger points. I thought it was kind of interesting when they discussed Donald Trump's rallies, you know, his packed rallies with no masks, no social distancing, nothing. Biden did not bring up Herman Cain. And I thought that was very interesting, because Herman Cain, for those who don't remember, Herman Cain is a Republican presidential candidate who appeared on at the Tulsa rally this spring, and he then contracted coronavirus and then he died. So when Trump says, "Oh well, there hasn't been any harm from my rallies, they haven't led to any spread," and it's like, well, they killed one of your top supporters. You know, they killed one of the top black members of your party. You know, how can you say there isn't any harm? I was waiting for him to say that. I got the impression Biden thought that the corona debate was going to be a bit easier than it actually was. I also thought that he didn't effectively refute the charge about the China travel ban. Because obviously the easiest response to that is that Trump suggested a travel ban against China after the pandemic was already in the US and it wasn't even coming in from China anymore. So at that point, it's kind of like locking the door after, what's the expression I'm looking for? It's basically
closing the gate after the horses have left the barn. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. You're closing the barn after all the animals have already escaped. So at that point, it was a symbolic gesture. I'm not really sure.
And to your point, you know, more broadly, I think it was very obvious on at least two different occasions that I remember, but it's probably more like four or five, that Vice President Biden very obviously stumbled or struggled to get his literal line out. You could tell that he had a couple of prepared lines that are kind of a laying in wait trap style thing. It's very common. Every candidate from every party does it, and they wait for the opportunity to use it. And it's like a punchline on a joke. If you deliver it well, you capture the room. If you stumble across it, everybody kind of looks at you and go, "Hey, I see what you are getting at there," and it falls flat. And there were obviously some moments where that happened. Now, the truth is that it is fact that Joe Biden had a stutter and has struggled with a stutter. But the other truth is that he never once mentioned it in the 80s, 90s, or 2000s. And one of the problems with growing old is that you start to lose a step, maybe two. And while Joe Biden was arguably the smartest U.S. senator in the United States Senate 20 years ago, the other reality is he's nearly 80 years old. And
to be precise.
Correct. And if elected, he will be the oldest first-term president in the history of the United States. This is not without, you know, intrigue or interest. He's also the last baby boomer. Interestingly enough, this will be the last campaign in which two baby boomer candidates will compete against each other.
Let's hope
and
so.
No matter who wins the election, we will, you know, we're not likely to have another member of this generation, which is, by the way, the same generation as Bill Clinton, just for perspective, a man elected to the presidency 28 years ago. So this generation has been running the country pretty much uninterrupted since 1992, and I would argue they've done a really poor job of it across the board. And the last, quote-unquote, World War II generation president being George Herbert Walker Bush and Reagan before him, and, you know, Carter before him. You know, there was an entire generation, and I have to say that, you know, the World War II generation from, you know, Nixon through Herbert Walker has a better scorecard than the baby boomers. But I will say that because of that, he's stumbling in the same way that President Trump also sometimes stumbles, literally due to age, especially later in the day. And of course, this was a debate that on the East Coast of the United States was being held at 9 o'clock at night. So in most cases, I would guess that Vice President Biden has been up for at least 14 hours at the start of the debate, and possibly longer. So it's later in the day, and it's more difficult for gentlemen of that age to kind of bring their A game on a 14-hour day. It's just not customary. And I think he stumbled, and I think it was visible, and I think it has to do with age. Hmm. And if, again, if Donald Trump weren't Donald Trump, that's something that probably could be used very effectively by a Mike Pence as the sitting president or the candidate for presidency, who is more than 15 years younger.
Yeah. That's one of the things that, you know, as you mentioned earlier, there are lots of attacks that you could use against Joe Biden that are difficult to use for Donald Trump specifically, you know, such as the age issue, because Donald Trump is only a few years younger himself. I was going to ask about Trump's critical race theory and his war against that, but I just need to chime in here because we got the first poll of the debate, and it's a poll from CNN, and 60% say that Biden won the debate, 28% say Donald Trump. To put matters into perspective, in 2016, 62% said Clinton won the first debate, 27% said Trump won the first debate. So these are nearly identical numbers to 2016. It can also, from the YouGov poll of the from CBS, 38% of voters said that the debate made them think better of Joe Biden, versus only 24% who said the same of Donald Trump. And 32% said that it made them feel worse about Joe Biden, versus 42% for Donald Trump. So Biden is plus 6, Donald Trump is minus 18. Any thoughts on this?
So, first and foremost, historically, what we've learned is that the first debate is the least important debate, right? Usually the second debate winds up being the most important, followed by the third. The first debate is historically where the incumbent president, whomever that may be, does the worst, and or the expected candidate, you know. And so I caution anybody from jumping to any significant conclusions on either campaign at this point. It's important to remember that we're in a month beginning with the word September. And while early voting has literally begun it's still scant. I suspect that the second debate will be the one that matters, not least of which because the campaigns will have 2 weeks, not just one, to kind of recover, reassess, and redeploy in their methodologies for the second debate. I suspect the format will also be less friendly to chaos, if nothing else. And it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. That being said, I do think that, you know, those poll numbers sound about right. Again, though, as stated, it's really not so much Joe Biden winning as Donald Trump losing this debate, which is plainly obvious to anyone who wasn't looking through Trump-colored glasses, shall we say, because you'll notice that that 28% is roughly around the same number of people that think Donald Trump's doing a great job at handling the coronavirus, and these people are obviously just checked out and totally in team mode and can be discounted in the same way that there's roughly 28% of people, or possibly even 40, who would have said Joe Biden won the debate if he fell off the stage. So it's, you know, there's some numbers baked in there, but I do think the polls are pretty accurate in this case. And we will see as the days advance. I do think it gets difficult to spin for the Trump campaign. I also think that 95% of the people watching tonight were people who love politics and who decided who they were voting for a month ago. I think the second debate will be when people tune in to go cast their ballot the following week in a way that's not necessarily true about this debate. And if the president or Joe Biden has a big night in 2 weeks, it will completely overcome or eradicate anyone's opinion based on what happened tonight. And the story will be then the American voters have proven to have a very, very short memory. Sometimes so short it's disappointing.
And, sometimes.
You know, so accordingly, I don't think the polls matter much, but I also do think they're correct.
Yeah, I mean, it should be noted, as I also mentioned in my pre-analysis talk of the debate that I had with Ronnie, that it is very common for the incumbent to lose the first debate. It happened to Obama as well against Romney in 2012. When Obama was basically asleep on the debate stage for a lot of the debate, so this is not unheard of for the incumbent to do badly. But of course, for Donald Trump, what I would say is that because, you know, as I mentioned, these are the same numbers, you know, within the margin of error, the same numbers as Hillary Clinton had against in 2016, and she ended up losing. But it should be noted that at the day of the debate, on the night of the debate in 2016, Clinton had a lead in the polls of 2.3%. A week after that, at the night of the vice presidential debate, so from September 26th to October 4th, her lead increased to 3.8%. So she did gain from the first debate, but yeah, she had a very, very poor finish of the campaign. And the important thing, however, is that Trump is down by 6% against Biden. He has much more that he has to catch up, and there are more early voters, which is why I think that... Now, of course, pundits always want to create hype ahead of debates, but I think that this debate is more important than the first debate in 2016, because Trump has more catching up to do, and there are going to be more voters who will have voted by the time of the second debate than at the same point in 2016. So it becomes harder and harder to catch up as time goes on.
In theory, that's true. But what we also know from now almost a generation of early voting is that swing voters vote late, and not just a little bit. They estimate that in the first week of early voting, 99% of all ballots cast are hardcore partisans, people who literally go and work the polls, who are campaign volunteers, people whose votes don't matter in the sense that they were never up for grabs. So I would push back against that gently, in the sense that It's, are there some votes in a literal sense that are lost? Absolutely. But is it an appreciable amount? Absolutely not. And perhaps I'm wrong this time, especially because coronavirus is a different thing. And so we are going to see some voter patterns change, including the ways in which it is legal to vote and the time in which it's legal to vote. So, you know, we won't know until we do a after action assessment of the statistics, you know, 6 months from now, whether that proves to be true. But historically, and there's been quite a lot of early voting now for over 15 years, we do know that people who are still influenceable vote late, because they're actually still thinking about it, which is good. They're taking the debates into account. They're not just walking into the polls and picking up the blue card or the red card. But as we know, roughly 75% of America does do that. And so they can go ahead and vote because they were always going to vote for Trump or always going to vote for Biden. And it didn't matter what anybody said or did, which is really disconcerting, actually.
So I wanted to talk to you about the and yes, I agree with you on that, I should say first. I want to talk about the critical race theory, which I felt was going to be a very weak card for Biden because, quite frankly, the gender studies, critical race theory, intersectional feminism stuff, most of it is nonsense. But I kind of felt like Trump didn't do a good job because he didn't explain. He could have given examples of the stuff that they teach, you know, police officers or public servants or school children or whatever, of critical race theory, crazy examples of, you know, of the ideas that are taught. Instead, he'll say, oh, well, I pulled funding for it because it's racist. And to most people, that I don't think that really sells it. You know, I think he could have used, I think, again, he was speaking to his base, essentially. He was speaking to those who already know what critical race theory is, or at least have an idea and know that they hate it. And I think that identity politics is one of Trump's strong points. People do not agree with the left on identity politics.
No, by a ratio of almost 3-1, in fact. So it's a very, very strong card in the hands of anyone in the center or the right against any candidate from the left. It's a winning issue by double digits, double digits even. And but once again, we're seeing a campaign and a candidate, for that matter, who's lazy in the sense that they don't do the hard work of learning the policy, learning the points, learning the really good quality attack lines and the way in which to discuss them for 15 seconds, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 15 minutes, right? And that's what a really great candidate does, because they're actually really good at the job of politics and policy. And unfortunately, what we have right now is on display of what happens when the 15 to 30 second soundbite fully swallows the political zeitgeist of our time. And I would go to say that's an attack on, you know, a pox on all the houses, right? That's not just Donald Trump and the Republicans. I think it can be blamed for a lot of the Ocasio, you know, Cortez and even the Bernie stuff on the left, is that it's really easy to say something and throw something out there, especially when it's emotionally charged topic, in a 15 to 30 second soundbite. You know, if you give someone a microphone for 10 minutes to discuss it, they'll prove in 5 minutes how little they know. And so I've often been a big fan, ironically, you know, and it's why good candidates and good campaigns win through patient, you know, exposition. You know, the last thing I want to do is take a microphone away from a fool. I want to give it to them. I want to turn the volume up to 11. I want to put a bank of spotlights on them, and I want them to talk for 20 minutes. You know, there's no one who can stand up in a Klan uniform and speak for a half hour about why they're right and walk away winning more than 2% of a crowd. You know, the problem is when you bury things and when you conceal things and when you boil them down to emotional reactions, the critical thinking and critical, you know, logic is the first victim. And Donald Trump is a jingoistic candidate, as are many on the left, who are, by definition, reactionaries, and they grab hold of a moment, and it's happened. The good news is this has happened repeatedly throughout history in the United States and other countries, sometimes for nominations, other times for actual government, and more often than not, it is pushed back in the very next election as people realize, again, as I stated, the more microphone you give it, the more it, you know, delegitimizes itself, and rather quickly. You know, we learn that the emperor has no clothes. And while it's unfortunate that that came into government, it's not the first time. Sadly, it won't probably be the last time. And it is a cure for itself, though, because it's just so blindly obvious to even people who might want to agree with it but are still, you know, there's an old line from a Richard Lovelace poem, "I could not love thee so much if I loved not honor more." And the good news is that there's still a great deal of small swing voters who actually determine every election for the most part, who are very thoughtful with their vote, who are deliberative, who are research bound. And yes, they don't even make up 20% of the vote, but they make up 80% of the vote that matters.
It should also be noted here that there are a very small number. Most polls say that there are a very small number of uncertain voters left. Most voters have made up their minds, so the number of swing voters appear to be even smaller now than it was in. It was unusually large in 2016. But it is even at historical numbers, it's at a rather low level. One of the last subjects of the debate was the environment, which is kind of a troublesome, I guess, point for both of them. Joe Biden, because he has to push back against radical environmentalists who want to spend $100 trillion on a climate transition, which is money that you and I both know the U.S. doesn't have. It doesn't matter how noble the goal is, the money's not there. And they have Donald Trump, who holds a position on climate change that is not shared by 97% of scientists on the issue. I thought...
Or, yeah. More importantly, 60% of the voters.
Yes, that's actually the important... part here. So Trump said, you know, a lot of the right things. We want to have, you know, pristine water, we want to have clean air. He didn't say a lot about how we were going to do this, and then he proceeded to basically attack the governor of California for not taking care of forests better, blaming the forest fires on that. And that can certainly be a contributing factor, of course. But then on the other hand, we also see that forests are burning in the west of Canada, in the west of northwest of Mexico as well. So it's not exactly a regional problem. One of the weaker points, and I think this is again Biden overestimating how much voters know, is he said, you know, that you're not putting any restrictions on methane or something like that. I don't remember his exact words, but he was basically saying that the Trump administration is saying methane is not a problem. My issue here is, of course, Biden is right, and methane, the reason why this is a serious issue is because methane is much more dangerous and has a much higher climate change, a much higher effect on climate change than carbon dioxide, you know, kilogram per kilogram. But he didn't say that. He didn't explain why methane is a problem, and I'm not sure if most voters understand what the issue here is. So I think it's, again, he's overestimating how much voters know.
It's an absolute fact, both on the science, which you pointed out. Yes, methane. For those of us who speak English as a first language, I love you, John. The problem with methane is that it is 100 times more deadly, if you will, or more efficacious, you know, in terms of its ability to capture and to empower global warming
or greenhouse effect.
the greenhouse effect, most specifically, then carbon dioxide. And yes, people who care about this topic know it well. But to your point, I think that's easily less than 5% of the population and voters. Again, probably sadly. But yeah, I agree that, you know, the laziness of and preparation and age factors of campaigns, again, while Donald Trump's winning the gold medal on that, it would be fair to say that Joe Biden deserves honorable mention on the same topics, if not the bronze medal. The reality is that he is not waging his best campaign. He's just waging his most successful. And, you know, he was sharper, stronger, and a better communicator 10 years ago, 12 years ago, which is one of the reasons why Obama selected him as vice president. You know, the prevailing theory here, unfortunately, is that our weakest guy is stronger than your weakest guy for the Democrats. And it's probably true, but it's certainly not, you know, the animating contest of liberty that our founding fathers so aspired to.
I'm not sure if the founder fathers really thought that there would be presidential debates. I understand they weren't really a thing till the 1860s, and they weren't televised until another 100 years after that. So, but I...
Well, no, the idea was that they would write essays, which we would read by the fire as we determined dispassionately who we were going to, you know, vote to run this country. And I think probably, truthfully, we were all better off.
I mean, honestly, and one of the things that I liked about the way that we do these, well, we don't have presidential, but the way that we do election debates in Sweden, or at least the way we used to do them, you know, debates, if you go back to the 1990s, you know, we had debates that were over 3-4 hours long, with candidates talking for 5 minutes in a row, and there being, you know, facts, statistics, all of it very, you know, you'd address the listeners as, you know, honorable voters and so on. There was no clickbait to it. And it was not entertaining in the least. It's probably the most boring thing anyone will ever see. But people sat through and watched it because it was a civic duty. Politics was not entertainment. And I think that the... I realize where this is... I'm not going to try not to derail this conversation, but I think Trump's success and failure is that he's turned politics into entertainment. It's a success in the sense that a lot of people will stay with him just because he is entertaining. They want to hear what he's going to say next, but they don't want you to, you know, remind them of reality because they are in the... It's, you know, it's kind of like they don't... You don't want anyone to point out in the middle of a movie that, oh, that's just CGI, that's not really a monster. You know, you don't want anyone to ruin the show. But at the same time, it's a success because it gets him, especially the low-educated voters who are looking for a show, who don't feel politics matter that much to their everyday life. But at the same time, it's a failure because you have to keep the show going, whatever's best for the country.
Well, I will both agree with you and disagree with you in the sense that you're right that he has absolutely practiced politics that way, and to the extent that he is practicing that way, he is the height of achievement of this style of politics. However, I would argue that he didn't start it or create it. He merely took it up to a level that offends the sensibilities of many people, whereas most people, including Barack Obama, who ran a campaign where he did not put his own name on a political sign, which is the first time that's been done in major political office in the history of the world, as I remember, and instead ran as Hope and Change with a logo, more like a Nike or a Reebok brand, because, of course, his name, his literal name, is Barack Hussein Obama, and he did not want that to be repeated 100 million times to remind people how non-mainstream he was for American politics, or even the name Barack, or just the name Obama. None of his three names are traditional in America in any
zip code, let alone the entire country. And so he wanted it to go away, and he engaged in a form of politics that was brand over substance. So, you know, again, Trump's not responsible for creating that or even practicing it significantly. He just took it to what unfortunately is its ultimate conclusion. You know, it's one thing to, you know, we go back to the 1960 election, to your point, the first televised debate between Nixon and Kennedy. And interestingly enough, the television, while prominent, was still not ubiquitous. And many people, many millions of people, only had the ability to receive the debate via radio. And without question, the polls dictated that if you heard the debate on the radio, you believe Nixon won, which would make sense as a candidate driven more towards tradition, more towards the older methods of communication, versus Kennedy, who won. You know, and again, I'm not trying to undermine President Kennedy or his legacy. I'm a fan. But at the same time, he definitely understood the value of style, at least alongside substance. Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan as well. One of the major reasons Reagan was able to govern so effectively was his command of communication, of style. Now, I would argue that in the cases of all three gentlemen, you know, Kennedy, Reagan, and even Bill Clinton, they paired their style with substance, Bill Clinton less so, and in the process had an ultimate secret weapon, whereas I think beginning with Bill Clinton, but taken to exacerbating levels by Bush, Obama, and now Trump, is the victory of style over substance and the decoupling of those two things. And we wind up where we're at.
So as a final topic and about the final question, the final topic was, you know, the election, the integrity of the election, and whether both candidates were asked to pledge that they would ask their supporters not to turn to violence, to wait for the results, because as most who follow the election know, the results could take weeks. We may not have the results on election night. We may not have an answer to who will be the next president on November 3rd. So Trump sort of didn't seem to do that. He went on about how election fraud is a real thing, how they had started throwing away votes for him. And most notably, he said, when asked to condemn white supremacists, he said to the Proud Boys, which is a white supremacist, rather violent network, stand back and stand by, which they are now celebrating on Twitter because they saw it as a call to arms, basically, to interfere at or after the election. So and to me, this would have been one of the easiest wins for Trump. For Trump, if he just said, "Yes, I condemn white supremacism." Next question: why? What's his problem?
Well, oh, we don't have another 30 minutes to this conversation.
That is a problem.
Yeah, you know, one of the problems, many, with the Trump administration is he never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And, you know, to your point earlier, you know, you were talking about the lack of an ability to self-correct and to modulate, to change it up, if you will. And one of the joys, I guess, we can all have is that when we read books like Orwell's 1984, you know, one of the things that they were smart about, which is what made them so insidious, was that they would change their tune literally 180 degrees. If they were found out to be wrong, they would immediately get on the right track and then eradicate any evidence that they had ever been wrong to begin with. Mm. The irony is that Trump, and I'm not trying to give them ideas for the record, could have literally done something like that tonight. He could have stood up there and said, you know what, the handling of the coronavirus was terrible. I know it, you know it, and that's why I'm fighting against the deep state of our government that was responsible for it. And here's my new plan of action, and act as though he wasn't a part of it. And believe it or not, sadly, it would have worked with 60 to 70% of the populace, because they don't have longitudinal understanding, as you were discussing throughout our discussion this evening. And thankfully, his narcissism, and I mean that in a clinical sense, I have sympathy for the man on this topic, actually, but it doesn't change the fact that there are, real outcomes to it that won't allow him to consider the possibility that he has ever been wrong, because it would start to crumble at his self-imposed edifice. And in so doing, he actually steals his own victory away from himself, because if he would adapt, as many politicians are famous for doing, to the point that we think they're all switch-hitting liars, right? The famous waffle flip-flop tag on John Kerry, because he was notorious for trying to have it both ways. And Bill Clinton as well, Mr. Finger in the Wind. And yet Donald Trump exhibits none of that, and ironically, it's to his detriment. It's the pit and the pendulum. He is so non-characteristic of politics and the ability to change tack that it actually is affecting his ability to govern, and also later to campaign for re-election, because he can't allow himself to, what politicians would say, is modulate, to respond to changing facts and new information, which is the most common line of defense for a politician changing their tack. And often it happens to be true, that new details and new information come to light. And if you're an actual wise critical thinker, you would change your opinion based on new information. The problem is Donald Trump doesn't and refuses to do that. And so with that broad stroke, likewise, he doesn't want to turn any voter off. It's that salesman instinct of his that you never get in the way of the sale. And he doesn't want to lose a Proud Boy vote. Instead of realizing that in politics, sometimes you intentionally push 1/10 or 1% of a vote away, knowing that every single vote you push away is going to get you 3 or 5 or 10 in another direction. And you actually want to have certain enemies in politics, that it's okay if the worst 10% of people in the country hate you.
And also, one of the things I found so interesting, because earlier in the debate, he was confirming that he thought he was the best president for Black Americans since Lincoln. And he was, he's been making a push for the minority vote, which makes sense, he'll need it. And then to finish the debate by not in clear terms saying, yes, I condemn white supremacism, the Proud Boys, and every other group like them should disband, dissolve immediately, and confess to any crimes that they have committed. That would be so easy if you want to win the minority vote. Or if you want to win even a share of the minority vote that allows you to win the national vote,
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So and easy. We saw that, Mike Huckabee won every single election in Arkansas he ever ran, once he became lieutenant governor. And one of the reasons he won in a state where Democrats outnumbered Republicans almost 2-1 was he actually won the Black vote statewide repeatedly. And likewise, and a lot of that had to do with Eisenhower, right? Eisenhower's famous stand at Little Rock as president, and the ability of Republicans in both instances to gain Black street cred, for lack of a better, idiom, by thorough, genuine, unequivocal action. Because while many people are right to point out the economic disparities and educational disparities among Black America, one of the other truths to that is it makes simple, direct communication have even more value, and perhaps than it might otherwise. And in so doing, if you make clear, sincere, concise, and direct action that benefits Black America, hopefully alongside of all other Americans, then what you've done is instead of dog whistle politics, which is just poor form, if nothing else, you're actually declaring in a broad way an alliance with First Starters, that 10 or 20 or 30% of America, whatever minority you're speaking to, but also the, you know, white allies, if you will, who, oh, by the way, are also the majority of all white people, the overwhelming majority. The truth is that racism and bigotry and homophobia, and I mean the disgusting, disgraceful forms of this, not the subtle prejudices that we might all battle with as we grow as human beings, but real bigotry. This is the behavior of a minority of a minority of people. You know, less than 5% of people will agree with these really virulent forms of bigotry. And you're not doing yourself or your party, regardless of the candidate or the party, you know, label, any favors in the same way that it did no benefits, you know, to the Democratic Party to be associated with the radical left of the Weathermen in the 1960s. You know, it's one of the reasons Nixon won so effectively was not because Nixon was lovable. Everybody knew Nixon was a jerk. It was the fact that the left had succumbed to playing footsie with people who were actively involved in, you know, bombing government offices and equivocating on the topic. And in the same way that that lack of moral clarity in the 60s and 70s beget a generation of Republican leadership, so too, you know, Donald Trump's equivocating on matters of racial politics may wind up costing the Republican Party quite dearly. That remains to be seen. I suspect it will absolutely cost him his administration, and how much further is an open question.
Yeah. Also, just as an aside, because you mentioned Nixon, that's also another reason why Watergate was so incredibly stupid, because he was going to win the election without spying on anyone. You know, there was never...
Absolutely. It was a huge victory. He went on to rack up one of the top four victories in all the 90 or so, at that point, closer to 75 campaigns ever run. He's in the top 10 in victory. It was completely objectively absurd. For him to lose, ultimately to lose his administration and his place in history over a foolish and literally unnecessary act.
Yeah. Anyway, Justin White, thank you so much for being on. We really appreciate it, and we hope to have you on after the next debate.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure as always. And thank you and your listeners. You know, definitely without question, one of my favorite podcasts. And I encourage them to subscribe and to share it with friends. Thank you and have a good night.
You too. Thank you.
Det var avsnitt 1194 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, Sveriges enda konservativa USA-podd som finns för att ge det perspektiv på USA som svensk media inte ger. Stöd gärna på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0 eller genom att via hemsidan stödja på PayPal, Patreon eller bankkonto. Det var allt för idag, tack för att ni har lyssnat. We'll be right back.